there room in the music industry for middle-class musicians? Nancy Baim, a fellow at Microsoft Research who studies the relationships between fans and artists, found three career songwriters who all came up with the same analogy to describe how musicians can make a life on a smaller scale and with a smaller fan base. This episode is part of our regular Rethinking Music series, but it's kind of a long one, so I'll just let Nancy take over. If you want to find out more about our guests, just go to the blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Enjoy!
This is Radio Berkman, and today we're talking about thinking about music in terms of community-supported agriculture. And I have three independent musicians here with me who have been really innovative in adapting to the changing music industries and have been really innovative in thinking about how to think about it, and all of whom have independently at one time or another written or talked about music as being like a CSA. So first we have Zoe Keating, who is joining us from about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
Hey there. Kristen Hirsch is down in New Orleans. Kristen?
Hi.
And Aaron McKeown is in Cambridge there at the Berkman Center, where she's a fellow right now. So community-supported agriculture, the basic idea, it starts in the 1970s, as I understand it, and the basic idea is that people buy shares in a local farm, and they then share the yield of that farm or those farms, and they also share the risk of it. And in preparing for this conversation, I discovered that there actually is a CSA art movement, or that's called CS Arts, that's sprung up around the country, where there's a number of art organizations where you buy shares in an artist or in an art collective, and you get independent artworks throughout the season. So as I was saying, each of you has thought about this idea on your own, and I'd just like to ask, what is it about the metaphor that's appealing to you? Erin, maybe you want to start.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's pretty amazing. I wasn't surprised when you said that you had also found these arts organizations that are doing something similar. I mean, I think in some ways this conversation is obvious, and that's the reason why we should have it, actually, is to really deepen what is so clear and obvious about this model and the way it relates to music. But, you know, for me, to dive right in, I mean, it's about relationships between the maker and listener. I mean, in a sense, like, that's what my job is as a musician, is to think about that connection and foster it and share it. And it goes in a number of directions. And also for me, I'm really interested in creating a sense of place, and how do you do that on the internet? And, so for me, the CSA was a great way of thinking about what place looks like in terms of economy and community and art.
I was always frustrated that because I was in a rock band, I had to engage with the corporate somehow. But that was the only way for us to survive. I knew at age 14 that I was fighting a losing battle, because what they asked me to do is to try to be a rock star, which is evil. It's evil if you achieve that, and it's worse if you fail. Because once corporate enters the realm of the personal, like it must when you're talking about something as personal and ubiquitous as music or food, then it becomes denatured. These are experiences, and experiences are for the individual, not the lowest common denominator.
Zoe?
Well, for me, what happened was that I started talking about my business model being a bit like that of a CSA, just as a way to describe it, because people seem to be having a hard time understanding the idea that a musician might not want to have any middlemen, and the reasons why you might support a local musician the same way that you support a farm. And so I kind of stumbled on it by accident, and it's pretty neat to find out that it's actually other people are also thinking about that. So for me, it was just a it seems like a really good way to describe, like, the kind of relationship that I like to have with, you know, the local farms in my area, and how I think of myself as an artist, as being the majority of people might buy their lettuce at the supermarket, but for the small percentage who, I cater to the small percentage who want to buy the extra special, you know, lettuce from their farmer.
Kristen, you wrote some about niches also, didn't you, when you wrote your essay in 2007 about sustainability, where you brought up the CSA idea.
Yeah, I think a niche is the new local. You know, in as much as any cooperative is anti-corporate by definition, they can be considered local because even in the sphere of the Internet, it's a group of like-minded individuals. And I like that sphere because they're attractively faceless and therefore ageless and raceless and gender-free, et cetera. But at the same time, I think local is probably the future of music, so this is a nice platform to present that idea.
Yeah, well, and Kristen was saying, like, how at a really early experience for her in the music industry, she, you know, knew she was fighting a losing battle. I mean, I could say the same thing and be curious about Zoe's reaction to that, but it's really like there's like emotional sustainability and there's financial sustainability. And for me, holding on to something like, oh, I have this role of helping nourish and sustain and be part of a community is a much more sustainable way for me to think about a career, even just to get me through the day on the days when there's so much out of my hands and so much that seems like, you know, total bull about the music industry, like being able to hold on to an identity that feels like it has more inherent worth than, you know, I don't know, what is more important than growing food?
And the product itself, in that case, music also has to be organic and heirloom. It has to not be denatured. It needs to be bumpy and it needs to be real, and sometimes that's hard for a listener to get used to. Someone who's been eating McDonald's for their whole life doesn't really recognize an actual apple when they see it, and the same thing happens in music. If they've been listening to Top 40 radio, it's very difficult for them to step into the atmosphere of music that is organic and heirloom. It sounds very idiosyncratic to them.
I love the idea of heirloom music.
Yeah, it makes me think of a box of tomatoes that are just like all crazy shapes and sizes, and you sort of pick the one out that feels the most like your personality.
Yeah. It was. I just got back from the Medium conference in France, and it was the first time that I'd ever. They had this part that was called the direct-to-fan camp, and there was the word sustainable was kept being thrown around in like a lot of different seminars. And we were talking about what that meant, and what that meant to me was having a career where that lasts and doesn't just sort of have a little burst and then go away. And the way to do that is, i.e. be sustainable, is by having deeper connections with your listeners. So like, just like...
Absolutely.
So that's how you do it. And the deeper connection with your listener means that they're willing to splurge a little bit more for my expensive heirloom album.
But your albums don't actually cost more than normal albums, do they, Zoe?
No, they don't, but I mean as in more than free. I mean, if you think about it...
Mine do, actually, because I ask for listener subscriptions to pay all my recording costs, and they get the music for free after that. But it cost, they pay more than the record cost in order to get me into the studio.
Can you, one of the things I wanted to ask you guys was sort of how you apply this philosophy in running your business models, and Zoe, I want to hear more about what you do. Kristen, can you want to talk about your subscription and the Strange Angels?
Yeah.
How that works?
Well, my band Throwing Muses had to stop because we could no longer afford to be on the road or in the studio. Both of those things cost money. And we had a lot of fans. We had been fairly successful as an indie rock band at a good time for indie rock. And yet Warner Brothers made all the money, and our listeners watched that happen, watched us have to stop. And we were not a band that got lame ever. We were doing our best work when we could no longer afford to continue. And so they took me very seriously when I said, I will always play music, but you won't hear it unless we shift the paradigm a little bit. And so I wrote that essay, Thoughts on Sustainability, and started Cash Music, a nonprofit to help musicians circumvent the traditional recording industry at the same time, and offered this subscription program, which they get a lot of perks. They can come to shows, they get the record, they get whatever we can come up with to make them happy, but they don't seem to want the perks. It's like NPR, you know, they don't really want the umbrella or the mug. They want to see me back in the studio, and they want to see me continue working. I have four different musical projects, so there's a lot to fund, and they keep doing it. And they'll come to a show, these Strange Angels subscribers, and buy 10 CDs that they already have and say, well, Christmas is coming, you know, and it'll be March. I think they want to give because they know the value of music, and they don't want to live without it.
How much does it cost to subscribe?
It changes. I think it's $30 a quarter right now.
Okay, so
that's really affordable.
I personally subscribe.
Zoe, how do you do your business in a CSAE kind of way?
Well, it's so interesting. My business is really, you know, I took the road that was available for me to take, which was, you know, I've told the story before where I started out initially thinking that I'd, you know, put my music out through the traditional channels with a label. And I had a lot of connections from working as a cellist with other groups, and I was just rejected. And so I just decided to start selling it myself. And it became apparent, you know, because my career sort of has been over the last decade, as along with, you know, file sharing and what have you. It came to my attention that people were purchasing multiple copies of my album to support me, even though they already had it. Just kind of like what Kristen was just saying.
Mm-hmm.
And they would buy multiple copies, and then they would just give them away. And so once I discovered that, I made sure that my next recording I released on Bandcamp, which I did some, you know, that seemed to be the thing for me to do at the time. And so, you know, then people can pay what they want. And I decided that I had some sort of, if somebody ends up at my little farm stand, my website, and they're already there, then there's sort of a threshold, like a bare minimum, that I think they'll pay. And they can go get it for free quite easily. And so I have this minimum, and then they can pay whatever they like. And so the average price is $4 more than the lowest price if you average it out. And so that's really my model, is just to, you know, have nobody in the middle. It's just me and like these small entities that take a little bit off the top. So
another thing that it can allow us to do is give music away, which I think is an honor to be in a position where we can do that, because there are people who need music and can't afford it. So as long as now we have this very balanced output, we have balanced input as well, and anyone can listen to music now, and that's a really nice side effect of what we're doing.
It is really nice.
The other thing I was going to say was that I do feel like, I don't know, when I was growing up, I didn't have a lot of money to spend on music, and I completely relied on my cool, hip friends so I could, you know, tape their CD collection or whatever. And so I feel like it's actually part of this, my job in this sort of CSA model, is to convince people that I'm worth, if they care about music and if they care about my kind of business, that it's my job to convince them to part with their hard-earned cash. It's nobody else's job. And so that's sort of, I think of myself, you know, I'm there at the farm stand, and I'm using, like, social media, like Twitter and Facebook, what have you, to get my story out. And the story is the story of me as a do-it-yourselfer. And people who like that story, they buy into it.
But there was a given, there was a certain amount of inherent value to the sub-music business. Certainly when I was younger, there were amazing record stores and radio stations and labels. The saddest fact in this revolution and death of an industry is that those were the first to go. Where we got our musical education, died immediately. They could not survive this fall. And I think the fall is necessary because it was such an ugly business and it did not, educate listeners. But, right now we're in a transition where, we need to rely on music being available for nothing in order to re-educate the listening populace.
I like the idea of the farm stand replacing the record store, you know, in like almost like a curatorial space, right? So like, here's what is in this month's harvest, or like, here's the new releases this week. And I like that idea of, I mean, I think people want to know the story of where their food comes from. And I think that that's something like over the last, I don't know, like Nancy was saying, like over the last 30 something years has become more and more ingrained in our culture. And couldn't, as Kristen's suggesting, the same thing happen with music? And we are at a transitional time where we can like step into this necessary, I agree, void and try to change the dialogue around it.
There's a certain amount of, for lack of a better word, wonder associated with that. When you can say, look what the tree did. We're saying that too, like, oh my God, look what happened. And we've become the listeners as well. We're sort of all in it together at that point.
I am a latecomer in terms of like a business model for me as a CSA. Like I think it was only, I knew what CSAs were a few years ago, but I basically grew up in a hole and didn't know anything about that kind of thing until I moved to Western Mass. And, it is the land of plenty.
You grew up in a hole.
I did.
That's another
podcast. Aww. But I moved to Western Massachusetts where, we're very, very fortunate to have, both a group of people who want to farm and a lot of people who have the means, and the desire to eat local food. And, so I've only started thinking about it in the last few years and am at a place right now in my business where I've like finished taking apart the old way. It took me a few years to do that. And now I'm looking ahead, start to think about what can I do with my next cycle of things to employ this metaphor. But one thing that I did do, that I think relates to this conversation is that I embarked on a quest to get back all my masters. I have 7 records and was able to get back 4 of the 7. And, so,
wow, good for you.
And so
that's
in that
amazing.
Sense, you know, that's like thinking about the CSA metaphor. It's like, okay, I'm not farming on rented land anymore. Or, you know, 4 out of 7 acres are mine. And that's been something that's important to me, like in terms of trying to figure out a new scale of things is to get my master's back, sort of then start from the ground up from those things moving forward.
Yeah. That's a great break for me to remind people that we're listening to Radio Berkman. I'm Nancy Baim, and I'm here with Zoe Keating, Kristen Hirsch, and Aaron McKeown, and we're talking about CSAs as a metaphor for the music industry. And you guys were just sort of getting right to where I wanted to go, which is to think about this broader context. You've made some references to the industry as it was falling apart and some things falling off. Berkman is involved in the Rethink Music Conference that's going to be held in Boston toward the end of April again this year. What do you think is going on in the broader context? How do you guys understand the broader context that's making this such an appropriate metaphor?
Well, I mean, everybody's talking about, how do artists make money? And so this is one potential way to think about how an artist might make money. So it's very much on people's minds. The other thing is scale. Like, given the sort of the idea of a perhaps the music industry not being so top-down, you know, with several, you know, large labels, and I can see it sort of moving towards the world right now where you might have a lot more smaller scale artists, and we don't need to sell as much because we have
that's
a better,
right,
more valuable,
yeah,
product. So that's how I think of it.
Very important in that regard.
Yeah.
Top-down,
yeah,
so culture is just impossible to struggle against.
Mm-hmm.
It really feels like it's on everyone's mind. Yeah, it really feels like if I can know, I want to know, I don't mind, I'd be happy to, there's, like, if I meet somebody on the subway and we strike up a conversation, I generally reach in my bag and hand them a piece of music when I'm leaving. Like, I'm happy to give my music away and really glad to have that choice because it's about connection. And I think that I just want to know my listener, you know? I think it's sort of terrifying to me on both ends of it. Like, if I somehow blew up in, like, some big music way, not knowing my listeners would be terrifying. And if I was somehow, I don't know, the piracy word comes up, like, if I can't find those people either. So I'd like to find somewhere in the middle where I can just know who is listening to me, and what they might want from me and what I could give to them. And this model seems to sort of take care of that on a question of scale, like knowing who it is I'm talking to.
That's an important aspect of being treated like a craft person rather than a rock star.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's this piece of furniture I'm going to make for you. How tall are you?
Absolutely, yeah. And as much as I sort of like the idea of not making money and knowing that there is no longer any reason for ego or greed to be associated with this industry, it scares me that Trust Fund Kids could be writing our soundtrack, or that we would have a very important moving work that no one will ever hear. So this seems to be, like you said, a happy medium between the two.
I had a funny experience where I made this anti-holiday album just this year, and put it up on, I used Topspin, and put it up for sale on Topspin, and I used TuneCore as well, and I one of the taglines for the album was, you know, the world's first pro-queer, anti-capitalist, multicultural, I don't remember the whole list, you know, anti-holiday album. And I had somebody write on Facebook that was like, oh, you talk about anti-capitalist album and you want us to buy your album. That's hypocrisy. And it was really like, okay, let's talk about, this is what's also great about this craftsperson metaphor, which is that, like, I'm the means of production. Like, this is my labor, and it's actually okay to be fairly paid for your own labor. And I think people don't...
Otherwise, there's no more.
That's right, and people don't under... Maybe... You know, maybe that's, like, a failure of the quote-unquote anti-corporate movement is actually a misunderstanding of what capitalism is versus craft.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of misunderstanding that comes out of the entertainment industry, and I wish we could associate ourselves with an arts industry rather than the entertainment industry, but even when we do, there are a lot of listeners who will sort of wear those repercussions on their sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I had the experience again at you know, because we just went through all the anti-SOPA stuff, and so, you know, I was kind of publicly against SOPA, and I had a lot of people attacking me from a sort of anonymous text from the entertainment industry, saying that if you are for file sharing, therefore you're anti-copyright, and if you're anti-copyright, you have no right to make a living from music. And it was really, I found myself, like, I thought that was just a ridiculous argument. And then I had this argument in person with, like, multiple people at Meetup, and I was really
surprised
at the idea that this was sort of a pervasive idea, that if you believe that people should be able to share your music, then you have no right to make money off of it. Like, they were sort of exclusive somehow.
That seems so extreme, and it seems like a completely, like, talk about the opposite of sustainability. That's either, like,
yeah,
you know, you're going to die or you're going to live in this moment, and that's it.
Right, and it seemed a little bit to me, like, I was thinking, like, bringing it back to CSAs, like, there's often sort of this feeling, like, you know, when an artist or any business reaches a certain level, they're like, okay, you have to keep growing. If you don't grow, you're going to die. And I've always questioned that, not just from a musician standpoint, but that, is that really
true? No.
And I believe that things actually shouldn't, I believe that, like, exponential growth is, like, a problem in general in society. And so I see, like, to bring it back to the CSAs, like, I like the idea of small scale growing gradually. And that doesn't mean that you're against making money. It just means that maybe you don't believe that it's necessary to have billions of dollars. But
there was a time where my shows were full of drunk jocks and baseball caps yelling for the singles. That's not the world that I'm trying to achieve. I am still continuing to refine rather than expand my audience. Like, it's not for everyone. You don't belong, you don't belong, you don't belong. This is going to have to develop with us all paying attention to its value. And if you don't value it, then you should go find something that you do value.
That's so interesting. It makes me think about how people talk about the internet being more and more curatorial, and they talk a lot about audiences acting as curators, but you're talking about curating your audience.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I believe that a vacuum is an appropriate work environment, and I would like to feel, and I probably do feel, that playing music for the stars is your passport to heaven, and that's fine, and that's a full circle and a complete picture, and yet I find that whereas you don't want to give birth in public, that leads to self-consciousness, which is the enemy of your workflow. When a finished work exists, it is unfinished until you bring it out into the world and it resonates with others. I don't know why that is. Maybe art is ultimately a social endeavor, but I appreciate the opportunity to be able to see the work resonate. As much as I would like to just play for the stars and be done, that's not, a closed loop is inappropriate for at least my work.
And again, that's like food, right? Because if you grow it and then it just rots, even if you make money,
right,
you kind of failed.
There you go.
Yeah, and it's a little bit selfish. You want to celebrate something, and to celebrate alone is just a little selfish.
Even if you have a cute party hat. So part of this has to do with how what you think music is, and I've talked to some musicians who say, hey, I'm making entertainment, you know, I just want to distract people for a while, whereas to you, you're talking about something much more, to go back to your term, denatured, something much more sort of natural and organic and necessary, maybe. Well, I don't know if I want to say entertainment isn't necessary, but when you think about music as being like food, how does that shape your music creation process for you, or what music means to you?
Well, I would answer that one that it's vital. Like, just like good food and vitamins and nutrients are vital, I feel like music is a vital thing. That I only want to listen to music that is really special. I don't listen to a lot of music unless it's something that is. I'm going to stop everything I'm doing and listen to it. Like, I'm kind of an anomaly. Like, I can't just listen to music and then do something else. I have to just sit down and listen.
No, I can't bear music. It moves me so much that
yeah.
I can't bear to just have it on. I have to give it my undivided attention, unless it sucks, and then you just get mad.
I'm totally the same way. I say this to people and they think, what? But I actually don't listen to that much music either. If I need something on in the background, I'll put sports talk radio on or something.
I listen to podcasts.
Yeah, but I can't, yeah, for me as well, music, I mean, music is inherently an open loop for me. I mean, it's really hard for me to not listen to music and then want to make music. Right away, and certainly that doesn't work if I'm trying to do some other task, you know? So I also give it my undivided attention in that way.
It's becoming discerning, that's all it is. And therefore, there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. It's pleasurable to hear something wonderful, and if it's not, then it doesn't make you happy.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about music as being useful, which is what I think is another great thing. Like,
food is useful, craft is useful, and, you know, among those uses is certainly entertainment. But I think that maybe what we're all reacting to is the fact that there's a wider spectrum of emotions, feelings, and uses for music than just to put on your white hat and get drunk, which is fine.
Right. But if you listen to it and remain unchanged, then it isn't valuable.
I think that's true.
There's something else, too, I was thinking of just now, is that, you know, it's, you know, you can make the argument that it's way better to eat, you know, less really good food and rather than just being gluttons. And so sometimes I feel like that the world of entertainment out there is just sort of encouraging you to be gluttonous and to just consume vast quantities of snacks that don't really enrich your life and, if anything, make you slightly immune to when something amazing comes along. Because if you're too full, then you don't notice that that there's, like, this lovely, beautiful little hand-grown lettuce here. I'm sort of, the world that I like to live in is, like, less is more, you know, that there's, I have enough to eat, but I want it to be, you know, like, the most nutrients. when I eat something, I know that, like, it's, like, this lamb came from the farm down the road, and, you know, I'm helping them. It's kind of, it's not just for me to sate my hunger. You know, it has other effects.
That's a good point. I think the starchy corn syrup music that everybody has thrust upon them in every store they walk into and every time they turn on their car radio sort of fills their ears and their heart with crap to the point where they don't feel pure enough to hear real music. It is an education, and you do have to become discerning. Not that we want to be exclusive, but there's a sonic vocabulary associated with our work that is different for people, and their systems have to change a little bit in order for them to get used to it.
I do think that that brings up an interesting point where it's like, yeah, not wanting to be exclusive and not trying to set up some sort of like hierarchy of taste, but on the other hand, where I think the CSA model can also show where some of this is breaking down is that like CSAs are not available to everyone for a lot of different reasons, and that should be talked about as well. Like this process that we want to encourage of these economies of scale that we're working on, the type of music we want to make and the type of people we'd like to reach, like it's not available to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. You could start with you know, something Cash Music is trying to address, which is like technology limitations. You could move that to broadband access. You know, we can talk about that the same way that depending on where you live, it may not be possible for you to buy local organic food that is reasonably priced, if not, you know, priced.
Yeah.
So how can we? Well, I was going to just say, you know, the question inherent in that is, you know, can we address that as musicians? You know, like Kristen was saying, music really should be for everybody. How can we address that as musicians? And does the food metaphor, can the food metaphor help us address that as well?
Once again, you're listening to Radio Berkman. I'm Nancy Baim, and we're talking about music and community-supported agriculture with Kristen Hirsch, Zoe Keating, and Aaron McKeown. One thing that you guys brought up earlier is the idea of relationships between the person making the music and the audience listening to the music being so integral to this model in the same way that the farmer and the customers who've made a direct investment is. And one of the things that's core to CSAs is the idea that people are taking on a shared risk, so they invest in the farm, but if there's a drought and they don't get any food, they're out the money, but the farmer can still go on and make things the next year. And I'm thinking about Kristen's subscription model, and maybe you're paying for the quarter, and maybe that quarter she gets busy and doesn't actually... There's no deliveries or whatnot, and they risk it. What kind of, can you talk more about what kind of relationship you think needs to be built with your audience and how to go about doing that?
I was lucky enough to come with a ready-made audience. I wasn't sure they were willing to support my endeavors in this way. I have had people come to a 50 Foot Wave show, which is my noise rock band, with my first solo record, with their fingers in their ears, ask me to sign it, and then run away. So it's not like I even personally had a lot of crossover in my career. So I wasn't sure if they were going to want to fund every one of my efforts. I have Appalachian Folk Songs records, I have Soaring Muses records, I have solo records, and yet they seem to be doing it for the principle. They know that I don't lie, and they respect that, even if they don't like what I've done. But I liken what I do to being a scientist in a lab. I'm a dork. I'm not an entertainer. I go and I do my work, and whatever the results are, I'm just as shocked as the listeners sometimes. But at least I have no corporate sponsorship with a vested interest in the marketability of the outcome of these experiments. All I have is the experiment and the outcome. And so I give it to them, and they seem to have enough respect for that process to want to fund it, regardless of how listenable the results are. What I thought would happen is that all these rich rock stars who say I got them into music in the first place, that I influenced their bands or whatever, would help. There isn't a single one that has produced a strange angel. And there are lots of musicians that have a lot of money who say I influenced them, but I'm sort of glad that I didn't get any sugar daddies. It's just, it hurts me a little bit that I'm asking people who don't have a lot of money for money, but they just keep getting.
Well, I think it's a lot what Kristen is saying. It's about trust. And it's about an overall ethos of what you stand for as an artist. And I'm similar to Kristen. And I have all my records are very different styles, and it all makes sense to me, and it's always all made sense to me, and it's always been somewhat baffling to me that like is sort of like the first line about me is eclectic. It's like, well, okay. But what I've been asking of my listeners so far is to I've been, rather than sort of like narrowing and narrowing and narrowing my topics in my Twitter feed or my blogs, has been to actually to show more of myself and to expand more of what, because I'm a massive sports fan. So if you are going to follow me on Twitter, you're going to get some sports. And I really care quite a lot about politics. So if you're going to follow my blog, you're going to see my anti-SOPA letter. And so what I've been doing is trying to show as much of my whole self as possible. And then I don't feel like I'm hiding any part of me or trying to market a specific part of me, which is also exhausting to have to do that. So just like be the whole self of me. And if people want to come along for the ride, then that's an umbrella that hopefully enough people can get under. One of the things I wanted to mention along those lines is I've been doing these concerts from my house, these internet concerts called Cabin Fever. And they're basically like Wayne's World meets the Judy Garland show. And they're this opportunity for me to like embrace my love of vaudeville, embrace my desire to be a host, cover, you know, Basketball by Curtis Blow, and show people this rural place that I live in. And, you know, my own songwriting in those contexts is kind of at the bottom of the list. But if somebody likes that, then I, you know, hope they're also going to like my new album, which is quite serious. And they liked my other album, which was funny anti-holiday song. So I'm asking people to see the whole me, which is, I think, more transparent and certainly less exhausting for me than to try to just be this sort of like one tiny brand.
Zoe? I definitely agree with that. It's very much that the whole me is a really good way to put it. Because it's like, you know, people might be out there and they can listen to the music, and then, but if they want to know about me, the only way that they can find out is via the interwebs. So, you know, Twitter and Facebook and what have you. And so I just go back to that thing of that I use those platforms to get across the entire story of my life, and that because I do feel that I'm sure for some listeners, they just like the music on itself, and that's awesome that they do. But I'm sure for some people, it's about the story, and you know, they're buying into a whole thing.
I read this really great book recently that kind of solidified my thinking about the CSA model. It's called The Dirty Life by Kristen Kimball. And, you know, it's a little bit of, it's, you know, she was an ad executive or something similarly humanless in New York City, and then met this guy and falls in love with being a farmer, and she writes a book about it. And that part of it is, we've heard that story before, but the way she writes about it is really great. And the actual farm that she and her husband create, the Essex Farm in Vermont, is what's called a whole diet CSA. So they ask their subscribers to pay for food the entire year, not just the produce growing season, and they offer them dairy and meat and eggs, as well as more traditional things like kale and root vegetables. And they make honey for them. And they're trying to provide, they want to be a place where this is the only place you need to go to get food. And it's ambitious and difficult, and there aren't that many of them. But I like that idea of like, okay, well, here's the whole me. I can be a whole diet CSA.
But you wouldn't want people to only listen to your music, would you?
No, of course not. No, of course not. But that idea of like, the idea of a complete self and like trying to offer, you know, of course, trying to offer.
It kind of raises the question of alliances, though, and like some labels are doing subscription models and trying to, and the arts thing that I was talking about earlier, they are, I think it's 9 artists that they bring together that you buy a share in a collaborative. Do you think that there's room, or that it's important to build alliances amongst artists with the common vision?
I just jump in and say absolutely, because I there's limits to my imagination for sure, whether it's marketing or art. Like, I just can only think to the limits of my imagination, and collaborating with someone else pushes me. And you know, anything I can do to get myself to do unexpected things is good for everybody.
We've also lost that concept of a theme that was so attractive to the listener and so helpful to bands, that we built sounds that way. In the past, we built tours that way, and those are alliances that we no longer have.
One of the things that you have all hit on a lot is the idea of a niche and the bumpy heirloom that's maybe a little less lovable but tastes better, or at least it's better for you if it's kale. One of the things that, and we've talked about the idea that of all this gluttonous, what did you call it, starchy corn syrup music that's out there, but it seems like a lot of people really like that stuff, right? They really enjoy sanitized pop that doesn't really provide any nutritional value. And the same way that people kind of like shopping at Super Target or Super Walmart and don't really want to go to a CSA because it takes extra trouble and so on. Do you think that there's room for this outside niche artists? Do you think that it has to be niche? Or do you think there's room to expand the niche so that more people want to be involved as audience members in a model like this?
I think if we continue their musical education, certainly they will begin to demand quality. And if we can keep it from being so exclusive, then absolutely. My music is more expensive on the one hand to a Strange Angel subscriber, but they allow me to give it away for nothing to anyone else. So that kind of exclusivity is different. They're not buying Martha Stewart's goat cheese. They're actually, they can create their soundtrack out of the music that's available in the ether right now.
I think enough, you know, I mean, we've all seen the sort of like quick rise and fall of so many personalities, trends, genres in the sort of mainstream music world. And I think that, you know, what's left will continue to be us. You know what I mean? And I think like that's, I think that all that stuff is going to keep rising and falling and whim and fancy. And then there will just be this layer of artists who are consistently thinking about this. I mean, honestly, like I think like in 20 years, Katy Perry probably has a Strange Angels, you know? And as I think she, for example, like I think she's a great songwriter and think she'll probably do this for a long time. And when the mainstream music industry is done with her, I could imagine her doing something else like that, or Kelly Clarkson, or, you know, any number of artists. I feel like when people stop, when artists stop being tired of being raised and lowered based on these mainstream or corporate whims, you know, I think there's always going to be this layer of folks like us who are trying to do it in a different way.
Yeah, inherent in the concept of being in is that you'll be out someday. So if you work in the corner of business, you can keep working.
Yeah. I was going to say, for me, like, I like the niche model. I like the idea of there being thousands and thousands of different little niches. And I don't think for myself that I'm really that scalable. I don't want to be very scalable. Like, I don't want to be... I don't want to be in the supermarket because I want to keep doing small shows. So I've already got to a state in some cities where it's like I have to do multiple nights, you know, and I'll do, instead of doing one big show, I like to do, say, like three small shows. And it's sort of like it gets more and more and more complicated to get bigger. And it's like I think that, you know, not everybody wants the expensive lettuce. And so there's always going to be subcultures who are really, I've always thought of myself as being like a subculture kind of person. And I think of that they're my audience and they're my pals, you know. It's like I'm making music for people who I might have the same kind of values with. I always like to imagine that if someone...
I think it's much better to sell millions of records over 25 years than it is in over the course of 1 year.
And you're forgetting the miracle of compound interest.
Yeah. But it might not be true, but I do often feel like if someone, say, you know, I'm playing for a random room of 1,000 people, if 100 of them really like the music, I feel like I might actually like those 100 people. So that might actually not be true, but I think of it that way. So it's sort of like I like being in the subculture, and I always feel like a little, a little betrayed whenever something that I'm really into becomes mainstream. So maybe, hopefully, the idea of the CSA is like we can make it mainstream but stay niche.
I think it's totally possible. Totally possible.
I mean, there's organic sessions in every grocery store now, right? So, or maybe not everyone. Not CSA, but at least you can get a bumpy heirloom tomato.
Well, and the idea that people might still reach for mainstream music when they want what mainstream music can provide them, and also know that there is, you know, the farm stand at zoekeating.com.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if people know what help feels like. And as soon as they do, as soon as they are educated food-wise, they'll come to demand that level of physicality, that this kind of that humming aliveness that they haven't felt when they're trying to live on the corn syrup starch thing. And music is the same. I'm not sure they know that it can shake your spine enough to change you in a moment. I'm not sure they've stood in a room with a bunch of other people who are allowing the music to resonate and that bounces back off the musician and bounces off the listener. I just think we're in this period of transition where we're going to see it. They're going to begin demanding that amount of psychological shakeup that music can give them, and that ultimately leads to psychological health.
This is Nancy Bain. This is Radio Berkman. We're talking about music as CSAs with Aaron McCune and Kristen Hirsch and Zoe Keating. One of the things you guys have been talking about is the scene, Kristen, you especially, and I think you said the niche is the new local, which is a great, great turn of phrase. What do you think is the role of the geographic local now? I mean, one of the things that's happened with the Internet, of course, is that the music's global flows have increased and people are finding all these fluke audiences in places like Indonesia or Brazil where they never thought they were going to find themselves.
And at the same time, record stores are dying and some places are finding the clubs closing down. And local radio stations are certainly being challenged right now. What is the place of the local? What do you think is going on at the local and what needs to go on at the local level?
I did a year of playing house shows once to see, you know, what was up with it. And it was interesting to me that often I would be sitting in a house where all the audience members were in bands with each other, and there was no question of that music reaching any audience other than the people that were in that room. I'm not sure if I'm putting this right, but it took me a long time to figure out that they were all in different bands with each other and that they would become each other's audiences. They wouldn't even play clubs. They would go to each other's rehearsal spaces and listen to their practices and talk about each song, and then they would all go to another practice space and listen to that music being played. And that's the kind of closed loop I can get behind. And yet at the same time, I can be on Twitter and get a charge. I was talking to somebody across the globe who barely speaks English but speaks music. So I don't know. There seems to be two things happening at once that are very different and yet somehow related.
Yeah, I would like to have some sort of balance between those things too, because, I mean, for an artist of the size of myself, like, an internet audience is, you know, like a kind of a worldwide aggregate for me. Like, there's some places I can go and play to a large amount of people and have it be affordable. And there's some places I'll never get to, at least at the scale I am now. And the internet, you know, allows me to also, you know, have some type of audience that I'll never possibly get to in that sense, yet local in that sense, because we share values, we have this relationship of shared risk and reward with our, you know, CSA model. And I want both because, you know, I can't live without the feeling of people in a room. Like, it's really absolutely the best thing. And so if one can feed the other, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'd like to feel like there can be some kind of, like, balance and those things can coexist and feed each other. The internet and its wide reach allows me some type of sustainability to continue to go out and go flesh to flesh with people.
Yeah, we're bodies, and sound waves matter when it comes to bodies. That's a hard thing to think that we're losing, because people talk about record sales falling, the ticket sales have fallen too, and I think it's due to the fact that they've lost that musical education. The clubs also died when the good record stores died and good radio died, and there are certainly some great clubs left, and yet there isn't that idea that this is what we do at night. We all go and we listen to music and we listen to local music, or we come to the opening band. There isn't that idea that we have to give live music a chance yet. I think it could come back, but the internet isn't really helping us remember that we're bodies that need to be in rooms together sometimes.
I feel like, you know, the idea of venues, that sometimes it's come up a lot for me, because I started out in playing my career in a warehouse that I lived in, and I found that there weren't any venues for me to perform in, both because I was unknown and also because I didn't want to play in a bar. And so, like, the warehouse that I lived in with a bunch of other artists, it really became, we sort of made it a scene. There were other musicians living there, and we would throw around concerts with our friends' bands, and I would play cello with those bands, and it was like a place that people knew about, and you would go and you'd hear interesting music. And I found that as my career has grown, there seems to be kind of a lack of venues in the established music world. You have the sort of the sit-down classical concert halls built in a certain era, and then you have the clubs. And I don't feel like my music and some of the artists I think of who live in this sort of niche/CSA music world, I don't always feel like the venues match up with that. And so it's things like you might rent a church and hire a sound system, or get a warehouse, somebody has a warehouse, or you're doing house concerts, or So that it does feel like the local part is important, but then, you know, I'm the same way that I can't live without my international internet audience because they allow it.
You're so right. That's a huge problem. I was just talking to Ian Mackay about this because he has his band, the Evens, now. They can actually go play these DIY rooms that Fugazi couldn't play because they were too loud. And I have that problem, too. I'm having to, as much as I want to side with the DIY rooms, I can't bring 50-foot wave to them because we're too noisy. Even solo or with Throwing Muses, which is a more arty, quieter band, it's not quiet enough for the grown-up squeaky chair rooms, and yet rock clubs are not really what we want either. We want a listening room that isn't for white people, you know? There doesn't seem to be any in-between right now.
There's an artist that that I heard about. I hope I'm saying her name right, but Kim Bookbinder. Maybe you know the story, she did that really great project where she basically kickstarted Per City. So if you wanted her to come to Denver, then you know. And I think that's great. That's like project by project, city by city, like what works in scales for those places. And I think it also, if I'm not mistaken, allowed her the freedom to kind of not be beholden to the club in town.
Having to seek out a promoter who is willing to take a risk and then maybe have them experience a loss in your name, which is sad. She was really cute with that thing. Like, well, sometimes I play a show and nobody comes. Like, hardly anybody would admit that, but it was time for somebody to admit it and say, like, this is backwards.
Because that is, I have to say, that is just one of the most terrible feelings ever, you know? And I think after enough years, you run out of the sort of, like, self-soothing excuses, like, oh, it's the economy, and, there was something bigger happening later than, nobody did the press, there were no posters, like, enough, like, it just feels terrible. Yeah, it just feels terrible, and you know, I'm, at this point, for me, I don't want to feel terrible. I'd like to find ways to feel really great about what I'm doing and the people I'm doing it for.
Well, I think we're still fighting that art versus entertainment conundrum. Because we should never have been asked to be entertainers. There should never have been real musicians in that industry. Real musicians should have another name for what they do, and I suppose art is the best one we have, but we're waiting for the system to catch up, both live and recorded.
We're actually getting to the end of our hour, even though I kind of have a feeling we could go for hours and hours, but you've mentioned a number of specific platforms or tools that you find helpful. Cash Music, which just launched their platform, this week, right? And Topspin, Bandcamp, TuneCore. I know one of the things when I go to music industry events and listen to musicians talk, and you guys can back me up on this, is a lot of people seem really overwhelmed by this. Like, oh, my gosh, now I have to spend all my time marketing myself on social media. How will I ever actually make music? Assuming that some of the people listening to this are going to be musicians who feel that way, can we end with some practical advice for people on tools and platforms that are really useful if you'd like to implement this way of thinking? Kristen, why don't you talk about Cash Music, since it is just this week, right, that the platform got launched?
Yeah, I'm really impressed with what Cash is doing right now. I'm really proud of everyone. But ultimately, it's simply a way to offer software tools to musicians free of charge. And you can use these tools however you like. It's fun and easy to go to cashmusic.org and just click around and see how different musicians use them. The subscriber model is mine. There are many different ones. It's certainly where I would go if I were just beginning to find my people. And like Aaron and Zoe both said, we need friends in this world, and that's what the social marketing is for. It doesn't feel like selling yourself the way it did in the old days when I was doing photo shoots and talking to DJs who didn't know who I was, that's the ugly kind of selling. This is making friends, and Cash Music comes with a set of ready-made friends.
I love Cash Music. It was definitely at the top of my list. And the others that I mentioned, TuneCore, Bandcamp, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that I would say, when I was considering this question ahead of time, is that the most important thing that I learned was more than 10 years ago, I learned how to build websites. Just really simple, like really understand HTML, cut and paste, like freeware editors, and it was this foundation for me of understanding and having the tools of creating something on the internet that reflects who I am just as much as what one of my songs sounds like. And it was so hard in those days to ask someone to change a tour date and have it take 2 days, you know? And so somebody showed me how to do it, and I had access to a server through a great organization in Providence called AS220. And they gave me the tools to do that stuff, and I actually think that that's the most important thing that I could offer, is like learn. And it's actually even easier now with tools like Cash Music or WordPress or Tumblr, make it pretty easy to create an online presence that really reflects you.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been Radio Berkman. I'm Nancy Bain. We've been talking to Kristen Hirsch, Zoe Keating, and Aaron McKeown about music as CSAs, and hopefully you got something out of it. It's been great to talk to you all. Thanks. Bye.